Hello and welcome to Ordinary, a podcast that aims to help Christians live for Christ in everyday life. My name is Josh Bannister, and each week I'm joined by Graham Nichols and Mark Bentham, both pastors of Christ Church, Haywards Heath. We are incredibly complex creatures. Everything we choose to say and do is motivated by a potentially irreducibly complicated entanglement of motivations, desires, and perspectives. As Christians, it's really important to be self-reflective. And in this episode, we're thinking about Dynamics of the Heart, a book that aims to unpick the factors that influence our thinking and behaviours. Enjoy the podcast, and I'll catch you on the other side.
I'm Mark Bentham.
And I'm Graham Nichols.
And my name is Josh Bannister, and you're listening to Ordinary. Welcome along to this week's episode. We've had a session or two now doing a bit of these kind of Zoom online virtual podcasts. So I think we're getting better at it. And I think this will probably be our best one ever. Yeah, guys?
It'll be our best one ever silent. In lockdown.
Let's see what
we do. That's what I mean. How are you both? Mark, let's start with you. How have you been?
Doing all right, I think. Hanging in there. It's saddened that it struck me about how long we're going to be in lockdown for church, particularly and not being able to gather in that way. So saddened by that, but also grateful for the ways in which we're still able to do stuff because of really good technology. And so able to do stuff like podcasts. But wearied as well by just, wanting to get back to normal, but it's going to be a while, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely for those larger gatherings, it's going to be a while, isn't it? Graham was, before we were recording, was talking about how it's a similar feeling to that last 10% of a road trip or a journey where you feel like, oh, I'm pretty close now, I'm pretty close to the end. We're past the peak, we're past the middle ground, but actually, that last 10% is actually in driving terms the most dangerous, because you start to switch off your mind and you start to just think, oh, I'm already home. And that's the most dangerous, but also ends up lagging and being really long, which I think is a good metaphor, Graham.
Yeah, no, I think so. I've driven a journey a lot coming back from France to the UK, and the last bit on the road to Calais seems forever. And it's dangerous because you're most tired then. So no, I like my metaphor.
It's a brilliant metaphor. Well done.
Yeah, I was similarly thinking to Mark. Not that we talked about this today, but I took a delivery for Caroline for something, and did the normal process of brought the delivery in. Then I went to wash my hands, and unwrapped it, washed my hands, put the packaging away, and I thought, man, this is just like one guy in a van, and we're thinking not too long before we're going to be 200 people in a room together. So it did make me think, yeah, I think it might be quite a while before we're going to be allowed to do that. So yeah, a similar feeling, but glad we can do what we can do.
Yeah.
How are you, Josh?
Today we're talking. Oh yes, I'm fine. No big changes. We were supposed to be, as a band, Lion of Judah, playing at a festival called Big Church Day Out, which we've spoken about before on this podcast, which was going to be this month. So there's still a bit of lingering sort of, I'm starting to feel the effects of not having played music for a while, not having met with the band and stuff, sort of just getting the chance to sing and play with them. And there's a bit of disappointment around that. But things are kind of, so Big Church have kind of got in touch with us about certain other things they want to do. And it's just it feels like a whole new world, doesn't it? Things have changed that you think, I almost can't imagine them going back to normal ever now. So it's interesting. It's just kind of getting used to trying to acclimatize to the new way of working, not just sort of with meeting online and things, but music and stuff, thinking about how we can reach people with music and reach our fans with stuff and performances. And it's just interesting. And I agree with you. There's kind of fatigue and there's a bit of sadness. I think you just miss the old way of doing things, don't you? But hey, it will be okay. We'll all be okay. I wanted to introduce the topic for this week. We are talking about, it's a book, isn't it? It's a book that Graham and Mark have both read. I have not read it, so I'm going to be asking questions. The book is called Dynamics of the Heart.
Yeah, The Dynamic Heart in Daily Life by a bloke called Jeremy Pierre, who is not French, although Pierre is very French. He's an American guy, I presume.
He is.
Listening to him. And he wrote this book. He also came and spoke at a conference of Biblical Counseling UK, BC UK, which people found helpful. So that kind of prompted a number of us to read the book. And I think overall the book is a useful, I suppose you could call it in a technical sense, a diagnostic tool, a way of thinking about the way we and the reason we do things.
The way our hearts respond to stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's been a big emphasis, hasn't there, Mark, on heart in the CCEF, which is similar organisation, I can't suppose you could say a foundation organisation in the States, and BC UK in this country, about looking at heart and actions and how they interact.
Well, yes, that makes it sound like they've come up with something new. But, I mean, of course, that's how the Bible speaks, isn't it, about the heart and how we respond. Jesus says it is from the heart that actually all our actions come from. So he talks about that in Mark 7, he talks about it in Luke 6, and he uses that metaphor of a good tree and a bad tree and the fruit that it produces. And what the book is looking at is the kind of the root system of the tree that is producing the fruit and how those things interact. And actually, to get that right is going to be therefore how you respond to life and to situations.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's biblical. I suppose the emphasis is newish. The emphasis sort of in a particular way of framing it is probably the last 20 years. It wasn't how people were framing it quite in the past.
I think it probably just got clearer in our language of it. I mean, I think the Puritans would have used this kind of language or would have spoken about it in this way or understood it at least in this way. You know, when you think of some of the ways Puritans speak, this is exactly the kind of stuff. But I think we got probably drawn into a variety of views influenced by the world that kind of then began to dominate how we understood maybe a bit more.
Yeah, and particularly in the area of counselling, I guess. So I think you're right. We'd always have talked about heart in terms of the affectionate kind of change where we shift our affections to Christ and so forth. And, you know, the heart being the seat of the both evil and good. But in terms of counselling people who've got struggles, maybe the kind of a secular view pushed in a bit too hard. Of a more technical approach that was more sort of Freudian and
I think that's it. And I think people became quite governed by, you know, determined by our environment, by our situation. We were responding, talking much more about our behaviour, moral, not necessarily in the church, but that was a kind of influence. And I think what these guys have really helpfully reminded us is that at the end of the day, we are responsible and it comes from our hearts. That's the biblical motif in that. And it's all done in relationship to our relationship with God. You know, we're not living outside of that. You know, fundamentally, it's how we relate to God and our response to situations in light of that from our heart.
Just to rewind and take things back to sort of basics.
Yeah.
It's kind of Christianese, isn't it, to talk about the heart? What that is a metaphor, isn't it? What do we really mean when we talk about the heart in a Christian context or in the context of this book?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's probably the heart of the book, so to speak, in the sense that it's the seat of the emotions. By the way, if anyone listens to this recording and hears a few background noises, there's certainly in my part of the world, there's this massive hailstone with thunder
going
on. So it's all a bit dramatic. And what was really ironic, and just to add a little bit of colour to the broadcast, an ice cream van just sort of trundled past us now with a, you know, the little tune playing. And I don't think it's going to get many customers with the amount
of
hail.
Day. No, hard
but
day.
Man, that is optimistic, isn't it?
It's just parked up opposite here, actually, and nobody's coming out.
He is one optimistic guy.
I think the heart as the seat of the emotions and the mind and the will, I guess, is the thing. So so not locating it physically in the brain or sort of in the bowels either. It's just it's the sort of combined effect of all those things. The seat, the centre, that drives everything else. I suppose the heart in the sense of what's pushing out through everything we do. Is that fair, Mark?
I think that's just, in that sense, it is very much the control centre of all that we do. Is how we respond, how our heart shaped will determine how we respond to situations, circumstances, people.
And of course, for us as Christians, our hearts are ultimately how that's governed is by our relationship to God. And so it's in that world as well that we're trying to capture.
Yeah. And so I guess it'd be useful to then, what's the kind of fundamental premise of the book? You know, what's the point? It's got this kind of model, hasn't it, that talks about the heart and the dynamics of the heart. Do you want to, one of you give us an outline of that? What's the fundamental premise?
Go for it, Graham.
Yeah, I've just recently read it, so I'm a bit more lively about it all. And I think it is helpful. What it says is basically the heart's not a simple kind of machine that just sort of self-generates things, nor is it just a kind of an information portal where you just feed in loads of information and so loads of reactions comes out. But it says that it's a combination of things we believe. So the so-called cognitive part, that's part number one. So things we think, things we believe, the way we reason, things we can remember, things we've learned. Secondly, there's the affective part, which is what we desire, what we value, how we're feeling, the emotion. That's the second part. And then the third part, the so-called volitional part, what you want to do, deciding, intending, committing, and acting. And so it's saying there's these three parts. They're not simply kind of three discrete parts that are three other machines, but they're three kind of ideas, I suppose you could say, that interact within a human heart. So we believe certain things, and that influences and is influenced by our affections and our wills. And then we choose to do certain things, and that's affected by our beliefs and our affections. And we have affections which are affected by our beliefs and what we want to do. They also affect our affections. And then all that whole thing is obviously been influenced by external influences, you know, which is, you know, God's word to us, other human beings, the devil tempting us, circumstances, I suppose you could say, they're all kind of pushing into that. And so we're interpreting circumstances, or we're responding to circumstances. You know, we're getting angry, we're shouting, we're choosing to keep the speed limit or the lockdown rules. You know, we're making choices and reacting all the time. Is that fair, Mark? Do you want to add anything?
Yeah, no. I think it's also just the voices that we're listening to is the other real factor. Yeah. So the voices of culture, the voices of friends, of family, that they all influence how I engage or how my heart engages in that sense.
Yeah.
So the book is... Go on, Graham. That's fine.
I was just going to say, I think we haven't got time in this little broadcast, but I think he effectively shows that those are categories that the Bible sees as well.
Absolutely.
So the book is like building a kind of a structure, a multi-layered view of the different motivations and ideas and ideologies that start to influence and affect people's behavior. Is that a good kind of summary of that?
Yeah, but also how we respond to those beliefs and ideologies coming into our life and how we respond to circumstances. So it helps maybe as a diagnostic tool in the sense of I respond wrongly to something in my life, angrily or lustfully or impatiently or whatever. And so you could, at the sort of simple level, say, well, you just believe the wrong thing. Or you could just say, I was angry because, and go very superficial, you know, because this thing didn't happen that I wanted to happen. But it's trying to get you kind of underneath that to say, is there a bigger lie that you're believing, or is there a desire that's kind of dominating your life, which is showing itself in this way? Or have you decided things? Is the will directed towards something that is basically then being threatened by this thing going wrong? And so that's why you're reacting the way you are, sort of thing. But again, Mark, do you want to add to that, change that, modify that?
No, I don't want to modify it or change it. I think it's recognizing how those three things relate to each other. But primarily, it's probably the easiest way to work an illustration. So, you know, how do I respond to, let's talk about COVID. How do I respond to the coronavirus situation? Well, I don't just think about it. I'm also feeling about it. I'm also then making decisions in relation to that. Now, at the end of the day, the reason why this is all important is because we're ultimately created to worship God. And I worship with my heart. It's my heart that is the fundamental place.
And as I worship all those three aspects, what I'm believing, what I'm feeling, what I'm valuing, what I'm then choosing in response are in relation to that. Now, if something else has captured my heart other than God, as I then think about something like coronavirus or any other option, those things are going to start influencing my desires. They're going to start influencing my beliefs. They're going to start influencing my choices rather than being shaped by God and my relationship to him. Does that make sense?
It makes good sense, yeah. I think also positively, it happens in the other direction, because you talked about sort of beliefs influencing other things, that I think I gave an example when we were discussing it in some other context, that if you hear a song, if you sing a song together as a congregation, which we're not going to do for ages, but if you do that together as a congregation, then there's an effect on the emotions, and it's not simply a matter of truth. The emotional kind of response might even modify your understanding of truth. It might be informed or shaped by your understanding of truth. It may even change your choices, having sort of sung something. So it's the kind of interaction which can happen in not just simply belief do. It's also kind of feel might even change your beliefs, and that can happen positively and negatively. So I suppose it's that sort of either way interaction. In the book, he says quite a helpful thing, which is how it works out. If you sort of took them individually, is beliefs work their way out as interpretations. So our belief system kind of interprets what's going on. Desires, second one, as feelings, what we feel, and commitments as choices. So that's kind of how they work out, but they're also all interacting.
It probably easiest if you talk us through, for example, let's see how it works out in the fall. Because when we see it from Genesis 3, how those things work out, you begin to, I think, just to try and help people root it in terms of what we're talking about.
So in the fall, you know, the story we know well, where Eve is in a discussion with Satan, which prompts her eventually to take the fruit, and Adam too. And in the book, it takes us through that and says, in this discussion, her beliefs are being questioned and perhaps modified. So did God really say, don't eat of the fruit, and so forth? Her belief in whether God is good is being questioned. Her belief in whether God has the right is being questioned. But it's not as simple as that. Also, her desires are being stirred. So it says that she saw the having the fruit, probably just as an experience, but also the potential knowledge that it might give as a desirable thing. So it wasn't just simply, oh, I believe this might help me. It's actually an emotional thing. And then that connects in with a choice where she and then eventually Adam make a choice. And it's, I suppose what he said is, it's more sophisticated to think, well, those are kind of influencing each other as well, because maybe the desire makes the belief more credible. So Satan says some things like, God didn't really say it, and anyway, you'll be better off. And if you're thinking about it entirely rationally, that's one thing. But if you're not then seeing this fruit and desiring what it might give you, that's then pushing back on your belief. So that might help the reinforcing of a wrong belief.
Yeah.
Which I found quite useful, kind of thinking it through in that way.
Mm-hmm. So then I guess, what's the application here? I mean, so ordinary, we want to talk about ordinary Christian lives. Is this just a kind of book that's useful for those who are going to be in a situation where they're counseling or pastorally guiding somebody and helping them to be self-reflective and understand their motivations and where those things come from and how they interact? Or, you know, what is the benefit of this kind of model beyond its, I don't know, intellectual structure?
Well, I think it certainly is helping people. I think as we seek to help people, because I think all of us, the bottom line is all of us are also blind. We're blind to our own hearts. We're blind to our own sin. We're blind to just how we often operate. So when I respond to something, I can see it quite simply as just, you know, X irritated me. I got angry. But actually, much more is going on. You know, what desires were stirred? What was I thinking or believing at that point? You know, was I thinking actually that I am so right and this person is so wrong, that I've got all of, you know, so there's pride at work there. You know, am I, you know, what am I feeling? I want to desire to win this argument. I want to belittle them, or, you know, other factions are going on. And then I'm choosing to respond in light to that. But Stunning Chaos has captured my heart at that moment as I erupt. You know, they've irritated me maybe. And as I think through those different dynamics, it's going to begin to help me understand what was really controlling my heart at that moment, other than God. You know, was it comfort? Was it I desiring to win? Was it the fact that I was proud? Was it the fact that I just wanted control? In other words, they helped me to begin to understand what's really going on in the relationship.
Yeah, I mean, he gives sort of really concrete examples to do with anger and alcoholism, which are quite interesting to maybe think about. But he also gives a sort of silly example to do with a glass of orange juice. So you know, his wife plonks down a glass of orange juice in front of him, and he's angry and offended and yells at her. And then he kind of deciphers that, pulls that apart, and says, you know, he's got this belief system that is actually the orange juice is not healthy for you because of the way it's produced or something, which he has expressed to his wife. And he thinks now that his wife thinks he's irresponsible or whatever for believing that. Then he has a desire that he wants the respect of his wife, and he wants his wishes to be met and respected, and he's committed to getting what he wants. So then he's angry about the orange juice. So at a sort of simple level, he's just a little bit cross because he didn't want the orange juice. But then when you dig underneath it, he's saying there's all sorts of things at play to do with my pride, to do with my belief system, to do with my choices, which are then working out in my anger. And I guess at a really practical level, if you're just trying all the time to say, oh, I shouldn't be angry, then you're probably not going to be as effective as thinking, why am I angry? Is it in the rare instance a righteous anger, or is it because something of my idol has been threatened? And if it is, what's underneath that idol? What's the kind of the underneath all of that, and what's going on? And I think everybody, ordinary people, can figure that out to some degree, particularly with their friends or their spouse kind of chatting through with them. You know, every conversation doesn't have to be a sort of psychiatric consultation, but, you know, just kind of saying, I don't quite understand what you meant there, or I don't really understand why you got quite so angry then. All those conversations, I think, are useful.
And the reason that that's ultimately important is because not only does it just then give me insight into what I'm actually truly valuing, wanting, desiring, but it helps me in understanding what I need to repent of. If I just keep it at, I got frustrated and irritated, I'm just going to say, look, I'm sorry for getting angry. That's the end of it. But actually, you know, and what do I say before God? God, I'm sorry for anger. Please help me to stop being angry. Well, they're all helpful, but they're not getting to the root cause. And they're just kind of putting a sticky plaster on the actually what's happening, because you're not actually dealing with the real issues of what's really being touched. And actually, more than that, what you're loving and worshipping other than God at that moment. So it actually comes down to what is the unbelief? What are the desires? What are the feelings that you are having for something else other than God in that moment? Now, when I dig those out and repent of those, then real change can happen. I'll stop being an angry person. I'll stop always responding in those ways, because actually I'm putting to death that which is, you know, as it were, sinful and wrong, and instead beginning to demonstrate more of the fruits and the right responses to how God is. Therefore, likely to get angry in a righteous anger, because God is so in control of my heart that I'm reflecting him rather than multiple gods that are not of him. False worship, false loves. You're looking, Josh, like you're kind of thinking percentage there.
No, I was just wondering whether, because I know that for myself, this kind of self-excavation is useful in times of, like, for me in my life, has been useful in times of anxiety as well. So not only necessarily like explicitly trying to excavate sin, like something like anger that is probably more obviously a sin than anxiety maybe, but excavating things like anxiety as well and being like, okay, I can go basic and say this situation is making me anxious, or I can go more deep and say, and what is it about that situation? What is that touching that is really making me anxious deep down? And my experience is that when you do those exercises of kind of deep self-reflection, there are themes, and there are one of only a very limited number of kind of really deep fundamental layer problems. One of which for me has always been pride. Like, pride lies, I think, for a lot of sins, for a lot of people, pride is kind of that fundamental base layer. Does he give any other kind of, an analysis of that? What other things can lay beneath things like anger? I'm sure pride's on that list, is it?
Yeah, I'm sure. Fear of man will be there.
Yeah, wanting to be in control, wanting to have comfort, connected with pride, I suppose, the respect of other people.
Yeah.
Perfectionism.
Say that again, that word?
Perfectionism.
Oh, perfectionism. I thought you said affectionism. I thought that was a cool word.
Oh, that is but I think this is and of course it's going to then be coloured and shaded by every person's situations, upbringing, circumstances at the time. So those root kind of things may be there. And at the end of the day, as the Bible reduces down sin, it always comes down to how we relate to God. Ultimately, I'm rejecting Him. And as I reject Him, that's then worked out in numerous ways of sin. As you say, some of them have these kind of fundamental idols, but then there's multiples, and they're all at work and all the play. So that's why having a model like this then helps me to kind of just discern what's actually going on in that particular moment, rather than trying to say, okay, I always struggle with fear of man, therefore it must just be fear of man, because it might not be at that point. It may be another idol's at work. And that's why asking those questions, having someone else ask those questions, helps me to reflect more deeply, but it keeps me from being simplistic of just thinking it's a wrong unbelief, you know, because actually there's emotion and choices that are also involved in that.
Yeah, he does well with the alcoholism in saying, you could just say, well, you've made an idol out of drink. But he says you need to go down a bit further and say why. And there are belief system things to do with perhaps believing that I should feel relaxed or believing that I deserve comfort, but also looking to as a tool to kind of navigate life, because you're fearing people too much, fearing social situations. So all those things are kind of underneath idols than just simply worshipping a bottle. But then the emotions and the kind of choices. So you make a choice to drink more and more, and that becomes habitual. And so your desires then get messed up as well. So when you're trying to help people, you're trying to inform their belief system. Alcohol is not helpful, but also their choices and their kind of habitual desires. So you're trying to address them both intellectually but also emotionally and practically. And I think, as I say, I think it is a biblical idea. Definitely what we believe influences what we say and do. You know, faith works its way out in works, but it also talks about good and bad choices. It talks about in James 4, for example, about, you know, what causes fights and quarrels? It's the desires within you. They're not met, so you beat each other up. So I think that there are biblical ideas that are there.
And the bottom line is that it keeps reminding us that we're responsible. Because in all these temptations, I want to blame others, or I want to blame my circumstances, or I want to blame the situation. And actually what this reminds me is ultimately I'm responsible for my responses, my sin, my choice. And those other things may influence and impact, but ultimately it comes from the heart, from within. And that's why just thinking about this in this way is a helpful tool.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Ordinary. We have just produced a new promotional video for the podcast. So if you'd like to share that with your friends and family, you can find the video on our YouTube channel if you search for Christchurch Haywards Heath in YouTube. Also, if you would like to use the video in your church service to promote the podcast, then give us an email and we can send you the file. Our email address is ordinary@cchh.org.uk. Join us again next time for a podcast about communication during COVID.